Welcome to the Sleep Super Conference. My name is Kirsty Cullen and I'm CEO at the Optimum Health Clinic, which is a clinic specialising in fatigue-related conditions. And of course, sleep disturbance is a hallmark feature of fatigue-related illness and something we work to support clinically on a regular basis. So I'm delighted to contribute to these discussions during the conference. Today, I am joined by Dr. Christine Schaffner. Christine is a board certified naturopathic doctor who has helped thousands of people recover from complex and chronic health conditions. She completed her undergraduate studies in pre-medicine and psychology at the University of Virginia, followed by a doctorate at Bastyr University. Dr. Schaffner is renowned for using a diverse range of healing modalities in order to help her patients reclaim their health. Dr. Schaffner, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's always an honor.
So let's start by exploring your description of sleep as one of the body's most powerful health restoratives. Would you be able to begin by telling us a little bit about why sleep is so important?
Absolutely. So I'm a naturopathic doctor, as you mentioned, and of course, we learn so much about the foundations of health during our education, but you know, they become more and more impactful as we're approaching these modern illnesses of today, which I often refer to as the modern terrain and why our, you know, patients are so sick today. And I feel that one of the key disruptions to why we're seeing such a rise in chronic illness and mental health issues is this mismatch of our circadian rhythm to what nature intended. And it is due to a number of factors that we'll, I'm sure, dive into many of them today. You know, but it's this, you know, disconnect from the, you know, the natural rhythm of light, because we're, you know, if you're not making a concerted effort to go outdoors, you know, you're in, you know, these different forms of lighting throughout the day. And then all the factors that are affecting our pineal gland and the production of melatonin and our gut microbiome, and we'll dive in, of course. And when you really learn about sleep and the many facets, we really need sleep. And we know this, right? Humans feel better when they sleep. We are able to approach the challenges of our day. We're able to, you know, organize our emotional, you know, complexities. We're able to really, you know, when we have a good night's sleep, that can make all the difference when we're going through trying times. And then when you dive into it, sleep is this profound event that happens every day, every night. And of course, many of our patients struggle with sleep, and that's where we need to really help them establish great sleep foundations so that that lays the foundation to heal. So we'll go into the different phases of sleep and what happens during that time. It's critical for our hormones, our immune system, our body's ability to, you know, consolidate and move past traumatic events. It's also a time for us, depending on what your belief system, where we can really unravel our subconscious and connect to maybe a higher power and become bring in insights to help us navigate our life. And then, you know, I think sleep, of course, is so important. I deal with a lot of neurological illnesses, and of course, with the modern terrain and all the things we're up against, we really, when I learned about the lymphatic system, honestly, which is only discovered maybe, I think, 2015, and you know, when I learned about it, I'm like, wow, everybody should be screaming about this. This is the key to unraveling many of these neurological illnesses, because if we can get the lymphatic system working appropriately, the body knows how to do this. And so that's, you know, these are all the facets I look at sleep. And again, we can go through them in depth, but I think sleep has to be, we say this and we know this as practitioners, but sometimes I think we can lose sight because there's so many things to address when we have a patient in front of us. We either think that they have this handled or we'll get to it, but I'm always trying to navigate myself how to bring sleep to the forefront and really try to give people tools to have healthy all phases of sleep. So that lays the foundation for the protocol moving forward.
And I know a statistic that astounded me recently. I was looking at Sleep Foundation, and they said that insomnia occurs in 75% of adults with depression. So that link appears to be super strong.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because there's this connection that, of course, we'll dive into more of mental health and sleep. And again, we can talk about the different phases of sleep and really how we need, you know, there's all this. I mean, you guys do amazing work about trauma and educating people about trauma. And I think, you know, we talk about all these modalities, but we need especially REM sleep in order to heal traumatic events in the brain. So that's just as much a part of limbic retraining as, you know, the DNRS and the EMDR and the Gupta method and all the modalities you do. So I think it's really, and we can make those connections in hearing those statistics.
So Dr. Shavna, could you start by grounding us in explaining the four stages of sleep?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is something I continue to learn myself. And, you know, all phases of sleep are not created equal. And when someone has a good night's sleep or a poor night's sleep or is suffering from insomnia, you know, with the advent of sleep trackers that more and more patients have, especially, again, no affiliate, but that Oura Ring that a lot of our patients in the US are, you know, putting on at night, and you could turn off the Wi-Fi or the Bluetooth that's connected when you're sleeping. So then it's just collecting data, and then you can connect it with your device. So, you know, a big part of sleep is mitigating your electromagnetic exposure at night. And so that is giving us insight that we never really had before. And also that tracker, just because we're probably not going to talk about this, and I'm not an expert, but the whole oxygenation of people at night, I'm sure you guys might talk about this in your conference, is so important to the brain health and to, you know, how you have energy throughout the day. And sleep studies can be very, you know, in America, you have to go to traditionally to another center. You're like in, of course, an environment you'll never be comfortable sleeping, you know, and they're trying to track your sleep, you know. So this gives us a whole other tool as a screening of to see people, like how their heart rate variability is, how their oxygen saturation now is, and then if they're, you know, what is the quality of their sleep. So I've been, you know, talking a lot about the lymphatic system for a long time, but I kind of like, you know, left it like, oh, sleep, melatonin. But we have to really kind of go into the phases of sleep and understand that we really want good quality deep sleep and REM sleep. So sleep is divided between non-REM sleep and REM sleep. So a lot of us have heard of REM sleep because we associated rapid eye movement and dreaming with this phase. Dreaming actually can occur in all phases of sleep, but it's most profound and pronounced in REM sleep. So there's in the non-REM sleep, there's N1, which is kind of light sleep, then N2, where the brain is starting to go into deeper waves of brain waves of sleep. And then there's something called deep sleep or delta wave sleep. And we'll touch on that more, but that's the slower waves that happen at night. And this is a big time for the brain to do a lot of the, you know, just physiological functions of repair, rejuvenation, balancing hormones, and so forth. And then there's REM sleep. And REM sleep is a time of high activity and metabolic activity in the brain. This is when the brain is often most actively dreaming. And this is a time when, you know, the lymphatic system is actually really highly active because of the increased metabolic activity of the brain. And, you know, the goal is, you know, we go through these different phases of sleep, and during an 8-hour period, we would go through and get 4 cycles to 5 cycles of REM. And these happen about every 90 to 120 minutes. And it's kind of like N1, N2, N3, REM, N2, N3, REM, you know, so there's kind of this like dance between the cycles. And so a healthy night's sleep is getting those 8 hours of really being able to go in and out of those phases of the REM and deep sleep is what we're usually looking at on the Oura Ring, just to really get a sense if the brain can get into that level, because there are those light sleepers or people who have insomnia and God bless them. They have to take sleep drugs, which even some of my patients have to do at sometimes. And we just bless them and understand that they're for a time and a place, but they don't get that quality. They kind of just get the brain unconscious and in a state of sleep, but they don't always get that good quality of sleep. So again, they serve a purpose, but obviously there's long-term effects that we find from these sleep medications because the brain is not truly healing at bedtime.
And is it true that we are getting less sleep now than we were, say, back in the 1940s? Has there been a shift there?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, when I really took a deep dive into learning about sleep, there is this kind of sleep debt that Americans have really accumulated since this time. And, you know, you can quickly Google and you can see that trend. And we were chatting right before, right, we got on, and that, you know, I feel like there's more awareness, thank goodness, but it used to be like a badge of honor, like, oh, I don't need sleep. I can just function on 3 to 4 hours of sleep. I can get things done. And, you know, there are those people that I still, maybe they're just more enlightened, like the enlightened yogis who just meditate all night. And, you know, maybe they're beyond the phases of sleep. I don't know. But for the average person who's just, you know, human, right, and not superhuman, that, you know, we're functioning like sleep. Modern culture and the modern terrain does not allow most humans, unless you make a very concerted effort, to prioritize sleep. So we are a culture running on a sleep deficit.
Frightening. And so what are some of the effects of sleep deprivation and sleep debt that we might see kind of walk through the clinic doors?
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned the mental health benefit, you know, the effect. And I think that's something that we definitely want to touch on because, you know, mental health is on the rise. I mean, it's been part of the chronic illness community for a long time, depression, anxiety, looking at, you know, mental health through the lens of all the things we look at, toxicants, unprocessed trauma, infections, but sleep is a big, you know, factor. Brain fog, of course, low energy, you know, even vision issues, because vision is a brain function, memory issues. There's a rise of cognitive decline, you know, in I think on the world, but definitely in America, you know, just inflammation, hormonal dysregulation, also blood sugar. You know, many Americans, and I'm sure in Europe too, are, you know, more and more insulin resistant and more pre-diabetic. And just as much as focusing on diet and exercise, that sleep is part of insulin, you know, management. So even again, I mean, that weight gain, aging, and then also just the brain, you know, shrinking or not being restored to its full capacity and healing and leading to neurodegeneration. So it's, I don't think anyone wants any of that, you know, so sleep is a really big issue.
Yeah. So it really stretches beyond the short-term implications, doesn't it, of sort of brain fog and what have you. We're talking about long-term metabolic change here, which, mm-hmm. you know, is fundamental to health and is mm-hmm. potentially improved and moderated by good sleep hygiene and sleep patterns. Mm-hmm. So if we take that deep sleep stage, what are some mm-hmm. of the functionally important things that take place during that as a stage in itself?
Yeah, great question. And so there's, you know, more and more books coming up on how to, you know, really dive deep on what, I didn't mean to say deep, but deep on deep sleep. But it is a time really where what we call memory consolidation. So we go through all these events, right, in a day, and the brain has a way of organizing and consolidating those memories that we generate during our day. It's obviously going to be a regenerative time for the brain. I mentioned already that this is a time of slowness in the brain, these slow delta waves. If you Google, you'll see the different types of alpha, beta, theta, delta. So this is a kind of slowed activity where the brain can slow down and repair. I mentioned also already the link between Blood sugar and blood sugar regulation. During deep sleep, I recall the brain increases its ability to metabolize glucose efficiently, and that can really help with short and long-term memory overall. There's a type of Alzheimer's, if you read the books of Dr. Dale Bredesen, and he types different types of cognitive decline. And one of them is related to insulin and blood sugar. So it's a very important time, you know, for our, brains to repair and to allow glucose to metabolize efficiently. This is actually a time where the pituitary secretes important hormones like growth hormone. A lot of peptides out there trying to replace growth hormone. And if you've had a head injury, you probably have low growth hormone. Growth hormone is some kind of youth promote. You want the right amount. You don't want too much or too little growth hormone. And it's this kind of fountain of youth type of hormone, and we're always trying to stimulate this. And so sleep is a time when the pituitary actually secretes growth hormone, and then this is also a time for the autonomic nervous system to basically increase the parasympathetic state. So we know, right, much of your work, right, in your clinic and our clinic as well, is trying to get people engaged in that parasympathetic state. And so it's a time when we really, can heal, right? And, see the benefit during the day. We have better energy. We can, have better cellular function. We have better function to promote growth and repair in the body. And of course, with the advent of the whole pandemic issue, and I mean, we've been focusing obviously on the immune system for quite some time, but, everyone has been in the last 3 years. Sleep is critical for our immune system. And I wish that was like a public service announcement during the time, go sleep, because this is, this is a really important time, for our immune system. So, deep sleep, that's just like an overview. We could go, of course, if you're curious or interested in learning more about deep sleep, there are emerging books. I love the Matthew Walker book, Why We Sleep. That's a really good like survey into consolidating research and kind of going into sleep and understanding deep sleep more.
Yeah, it's an excellent resource. And so if we transition from that particular stage then and come into REM sleep now, what distinguishes now REM sleep and its sort of functional capacity?
Yeah, so we mentioned like this, delta or deep sleep is a slowed activity, right? It's this time where, the body's, the brain is at work, but it's repairing. It's in a parasympathetic state. REM is actually, it's called rapid eye movement. So this, your eyes are closed, but there's this rapid eye movement that's happening while your eyes are closed. And your muscles are actually paralyzed because we don't want to enact our dreaming. If you are able to dream during this time, and this is a time of high, activity. So the heart rate is increasing, blood pressure is increasing, breathing is becoming faster and more irregular. REM is also a time where there's an increase in cerebral blood volume. So that's increasing this whole fluid influx into the brain, which is really the key to the glymphatic system, which we'll touch on. So this is when the, I believe that the glymphatic system is most active. And this is why we really want to not only get people sleeping, but we want to make sure they get into this REM sleep 4 to 5 times a night. And this is actually really interesting. I learned this from Dr. Matthew Walker in his book. And this is the only time, interestingly enough, we mentioned this on our pre-conversation, that noradrenaline is completely shut off within the brain. So when you're entering into this dreaming type of sleep. And so this is the only time in this 24-hour circadian rhythm period that we're, free from this really like stress-inducing, anxiety-producing, you know, hormone. We need noradrenaline, of course, to function. But we all, I think, could see there's excessive noradrenaline. Adrenaline is the body hormone, and also known as cortisol, and then noradrenaline is in the brain. So it's really a critical time, especially if you're in chronic stress. So that's kind of what's going on. I'm happy to talk about the benefits, but that, you know, that paints the picture of what's happening in the brain during REM sleep.
And what is it that's so important about this REM sleep stage that helps us with processing trauma?
Yeah. So this, you know, again, what I've learned, I've interviewed a couple experts on my podcast as well, that this is a time for actually like emotional recalibration, creativity, problem solving. It's also time for integration of the brain from past experiences to create like networks of how do we actually understand these to be, and what's the narrative that the brain makes of these experiences? So it really kind of consolidates our emotions and our experiences. And it's, you know, just definitely, you know, I mentioned this whole idea of, you know, you have to have, you know, basically your brain is devoid of noradrenaline during this time. On the flip side, if you have an excessive amount of noradrenaline in your brain, you know, because of PTSD, which is a very unfortunate but common trigger for poor health. You know, it's not fair that people who've been traumatized, you know, suffer, you know, from chronic health conditions. But, you know, getting into that state is like between deep sleep and REM sleep. You need almost, we can talk about, but GABA to help decrease the noradrenaline to kind of make that transition. And if you're in this heightened state of stress, you cannot make that leap. So you're getting less, you know, I mean, it's not all or nothing ever in physiology or in the brain, but you're getting less quality, less amounts of REM sleep. And how I have understood it is that REM is also time for that limbic part of the brain, which houses the hippocampus and the amygdala. When we have trauma, we understand, right? Like we have to rewire this limbic part of the response that the brain is stuck in. And so this is a time where the brain can really heal and repair and create different experiences of the, you know, traumatic processing is the word I'm trying to get out and convey that actually REM sleep offers our brain, which I thought, I mean, when I learned this, I was like, what? That happens, you know, naturally while we sleep, if we just sleep well, you know? So, yeah, that is what I know today of that experience.
Amazing. And so apart from sort of the trauma side of things, what else might we see clinically in somebody who's lacking good volume of sort of REM sleep?
Yeah. Well, on the flip side, right, that, you know, you have improved memory. So again, the brain fog, the cognitive decline, your mood, right? So your mood is definitely regulated. So if you're not getting good quality sleep, you know, when we have a poor night's sleep, we're either way more emotional, labile, like basically not able, like we cry more easily or not able to handle the stress, or we're irritable or aggressive or what have you. Also blood sugar. So that, you know, definitely, I didn't mention, but leptin is affected by REM sleep in a positive way. And leptin is, you know, we have insulin resistance, we can also have leptin resistance. And then we can just perpetuate, right, the unresolved trauma that we are plagued by if we don't get into this phase of sleep.
Yeah. And are there specific elements or specific environmental elements that negatively impact on REM sleep that we can target?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, just a lot of lifestyle things, caffeine, alcohol, marijuana use, opioid and pain medications, other medications like benzos, which there's an epidemic in the US with the use of those, also antidepressant medications. So I know antidepressant medications are getting more and more reevaluated. Of course, there can be short-term strategies for these drugs, but are they really the best long-term strategies for an individual? Of course, in a rich EMF environment is going to affect sleep as well. So if you're in a hotel, or if you're just across from the smart meter, or have Wi-Fi in every room, or that's gonna definitely impact REM sleep.
What I found really fascinating in relation to REM sleep and dreaming was that it's postulated in some studies that children with autism are suggested to dream less. And I thought that that was a really interesting research question around what that might suggest.
Yeah. You know, I can extrapolate kind of two thoughts around that. One is there is, just anecdotally, I know you know this probably from the nutritional aspect of B6 deficiency is often linked with low amounts of dreaming and REM sleep. And so you can think of all the biochemical pathways of why, also with pyroluria and also neurotransmitter inhibitions and so forth. So I think that's an aspect that probably is consistent within the patient population with children on the autism spectrum. Then, the other piece is I work closely with Dr. Marco Ruggiero. He's a dear friend, and we've collaborated on several products together. And he taught me about as I was learning about the glymphatic system, he was really evaluating and trying to find tools on how to improve glymphatic drainage. And he found in children with autism, they would look at the brains and saw that they had more of a pooling of fluid in the brain, and also a lot of cervical lymphatic cervical lymph node congestion. And so what he thought was they're not getting a proper lymphatic drainage. So again, you could just go through all the impacts of REM sleep. And when this is a time where our lymphatic system is most active, you can think, okay, one contributing factor to the poor dreaming are these children are not getting into REM sleep as often as they should. And probably for many, many reasons of not only the B6 deficiency, but the environmental aspects. Children with autism tend to be very sensitive to the environment, especially EMF. So I think that impacts us way more than we realize.
Fascinating link. Mm-hmm. We couldn't talk about sleep without touching on melatonin, so we will. So yeah. Are you happy to just explain why melatonin is so universally important and sort of the amount of roles that it plays in the body, not only as a sleep hormone, but beyond?
Yeah, absolutely. So melatonin, the more we all learn about melatonin, I have this funny saying, I say to my patients, like, oh, roads lead back to melatonin. Like, it has so many physiological effects in our body. So we can talk more about the pineal gland, but the pineal gland produces melatonin. Our gut microbiome produces melatonin. Our mitochondria produce melatonin. Melatonin is known for its circadian rhythm effects. So of course, it's going to help to induce sleep and to start the brain into getting into a sleep state so it can go through those phases of sleep. And it has this also important quality that I believe that it assists the glymphatic system in clearing toxicants and pathogens from the brain at night while we're having increased glymphatic activity. So it's highly neuroprotective. It also is a huge potent antioxidant, and that's why the mitochondria makes it so that it can quell all those reactive oxygen species from the electron transport chain and so forth. Our gut microbiome, again, our gut microbes do so much, right? And so they produce serotonin, which leads into melatonin, and then many of our gut microbes are affected and not able to make the higher serotonin amounts because of glyphosate and so forth. So melatonin can be very foundational in our protocols. It's actually also very healing for the neurological system. So we use it a lot to push things out of the brain that are creating neurodegeneration and poor neuronal cellular communication. So we use often higher amounts and in the form of liposomal or suppository or transdermal. You definitely want to use the higher amounts with a skilled provider because of contraindications and also what can be set forth when you're starting to unravel the body and to push and challenge the system by giving the higher amounts of melatonin. And I'll just kind of preempt a question that probably a lot of people are having, right? You know, why, you know, like when we take melatonin, especially in the higher doses, can we impair our body's ability to make melatonin? I just listed three aspects of where melatonin is made in the body, and I'm sure we'll discover more. We live in a very melatonin deficient time. We're chronically bombarded by stress of multifaceted types of environmental stress, chronic immune stress, even how trauma can affect, you know, all of these pathways in the body. So I don't feel that melatonin is harmful or will affect the negative feedback loop in the body. I know Dr. John Lawrence wrote a book called The Melatonin Miracle Book or something like that. You can find it on his site. And he goes also through the confidence of that it doesn't disrupt the production, any capacity of our pineal gland or our mitochondria or our microbiome. And you know, I talk to other colleagues and other colleagues who are quite conservative or very methodical, and they share too my sentiment and that the benefits far outweigh the theoretical risks. And like anything, if, as a clinician, there's a time to put the gas on certain protocols and a time to put the brakes, and you know there's a pulsing that can happen. But I honestly have been shocked and pleasantly surprised on how well tolerated melatonin and the higher doses are for my patients.
So it seems like a nice segue, Dr. Scheffner, to move to the topic of detoxification, which I know is a particular specialist area of yours. Could we just start by talking generally about why brain detoxification is so important and sort of pull together some of the references that you've made so far?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, when we think about the diseases of modern time, you know, again, you know, I very much believe our knowledge of the body is constantly evolving, but I always like to say what we know now, right? And that will evolve. That, of course, the brain is so important in our autonomic functions and our physiological functions. We're more than our brain, but our brain, of course, is so critical to keeping us in optimal health. And so, you know, when we think about having a healthy body, you know, detoxification used to be, I feel like, probably a seasonal event, you know, some type of, you know, rhythm we would have with the seasons. But as we, you know, get, you know, into modern times, I feel like detoxification is a lifestyle. And there is drainage versus detoxification, and drainage leads into detoxification. There's a time to push and a time to hold back, of course. But the big overview of this modality is, you know, the body is complicated, but also there are, as we just talked about, sleep. You know, the things that walk in our office as far as the all the conditions or all the symptoms that walk in, again, they're complex, they're multifactorial, they're affecting multi-systems. But if we get the body working better and its ability to clear waste, we often restore function in many mental levels that, you know, far beyond a pill. And so that's why naturopathic medicine and bioregulatory medicine and functional medicine concentrate on this so you know, so strongly, because it's really our job as facilitators for helping somebody achieve health on all the levels that we want is, you know, what do we need to get out of the way so the body can do the work that it innately knows how to do? And so detoxification is that. It's how to remove environmental toxicants of all kinds. And it's always in the backdrop for me with drainage, which is supporting the organs of elimination. So liver and gallbladder, colon, skin, lungs, also kidney function. And of course, the lymphatic system, which is the through line within the fascial network of really not only communication, but clearing toxicity, waste, and supporting the immune system. And that is, of course, the brain is in an isolation, right? So everything down here, downstream, if you don't see me, just from the neck down, has to be working and flowing well for the brain to appropriately detoxify.
And for those that are unclear, could you just define what the glymphatic system is by comparison and why that is so important when it comes to sleep specifically?
Yeah, absolutely. So the glymphatic system is the glial-dependent glymphatic system. So the astrocytes are a form of glial cells, and they really are the key to this function in the brain. And so astrocytes are these star-like basically glial cells that have these star-like spidery projections that make this network along the brain and along the neurons to support the neuronal health. And these astrocytes have these on the bottom of their what we call end feet, have these aquaporin channels that regulate the flow of the lymph and cerebrospinal fluid to bathe the neurons with the nutrition and weight, or nutrition and oxygen rather, and remove waste and remove not only metabolic waste, but all that buildup of aluminum and mercury and different viruses that get in the brain, Lyme and biotoxins, parasitic infections, and different inflammatory cytokines that constantly get perpetuated in states of chronic inflammation. So this system helps to remove that at bedtime. And again, it happens most actively when we sleep, especially during deep and REM sleep. And it's really a key to brain detoxification. And that glymphatic drainage has to drain somewhere. It's reliant on the blood flow into the brain. The lymphatic channels flow alongside the arteries, and they flow out of the brain by the venous system or the veins. And so we have to have good inflow and good outflow in the brain for this system to work. And then the lymph system is very much a hydraulic system. So if there's a stuck area in one side of the body, it can affect distant tissues. And so we just always want to make sure that there's a place for the lymph to drain in the neck, so then it can get recycled via the thoracic duct and the right lymphatic duct, that also the abdominal lymph is draining, because that's really important for the not only the head, but the neck, and the neck, but also the extremities to properly drain. So we're looking at that whole body drainage in order to detoxify from environmental toxicants that really disrupt our health.
And of course, the glymphatic system also carries helpful bacteria to the brain sort of via immune cells, doesn't it? So it's not just about taking the trash out, as it were, it's about bringing some of the good stuff in.
Yeah, it's a great point. We have a whole microbiome in our brain. Dr. Ruggiero taught me that. And there's a ton of bi-directional communication, right? We always think of, these messages going from the brain down, but a lot of the time the brain is collecting messages and microbes and, things you know, from the body, especially the vagus nerve, right? We know that the vagus nerve actually has more communication going from body to brain than brain to body through the highway system in the vagus nerve. So yes, you know, it's surveying and getting replenished and repaired from, and also getting messages from the body about what's going on.
So I know, Dr. Schaffner, you've spoken previously about the pineal gland, which always fascinates me. So could you explain a little about its role and about why actually detoxification is particularly important for the pineal gland?
Yeah, absolutely. So the pineal gland, pineal comes from pine cone. So it's a small like pine cone shaped gland that sits actually right in the center of the brain. And I follow a lot of what Dr. Joe Dispenza is doing, not only like personally, but I share that with my patients. And it, we call the pineal gland a neuroendocrine transducer. So it transforms light energy from our environment that the eyes pick up through the retina. And that obviously goes to the brain via the optic nerve. And it basically these, and also the, it's called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. I mean, there's a lot of brain parts to think about, but just very simplistically, right? It's taking light information and basically transducing it into chemical information in the brain. So it's a very, that's why it helps us regulate our circadian rhythm so strongly, right? It needs that differential in the circadian rhythm to look at different types of light and different types of wavelengths of light to know if it's, you know, awake time, sleep time, and so forth. There's a lot of other, you know, aspects to the pineal gland. There are these small crystals in the pineal gland that can also pick up, again, this is just a bit esoteric for a moment. I'll come back for those who don't want to completely go there, but Dr. Dispenza talks about, you know, there's this idea, right? The over time, the pineal gland is the third eye. What does that mean, right? It's a seat of our intuition, our ability to, you know, have a sense of, you know, the information we need to navigate life, right? And there's, you know, this, you know, thought that many people ascribe to and experience that we can pick up that information from something called the unified field. So the unified field is this sea of information and energy that surrounds us. Space is not an empty vacuum, but a highly charged, highly interactive space. So the quantum vacuum, it's also called, and the quantum field, Nassim Haramein, Dr. Dispenza, if you want to learn more, are far more intelligent in how to describe it. But for me, it's this ability to potentially access unlimited potential, right? Potential and information. So the idea is that the pineal gland is actually a way to connect to that field of information through the work of meditation and sleep and these things that we can, you know, do to support great pineal gland health. So that's why a lot of yogic breaths and the breath that Dr. Dispenza teaches really stimulates the pineal gland to get into these states where you can, you know, be in this meditative, contemplative time to potentially, you know, access different information. So that is, you know, very fascinating to me. And again, you know, another layer to go when we're looking at life, right? But, you know, the pineal gland is also highly affected because of its position and blood flow system to, you know, essentially toxins, right? So it's bombarded, like it gets the brunt of fluoride. The fluoride does calcify the pineal gland. That's not just a, you know, urban myth. It is true. We have a local dentist who does the cone beam CT scans for our patients that, of course, we look at dental stuff, and the pineal gland will be noted on the, you know, just a regular radiologist who's reading the, you know, interpretation. saying that the pineal gland is calcified. So this is, something that can be documented. It can be healed as well. So don't worry, but you want to make sure that you're removing fluoride from the water. Also glyphosate, through the work of Dr. Senev, we know that it transports aluminum to the pineal gland through mechanisms of increased intestinal permeability and so forth. Mercury can bioaccumulate in the pineal gland. EMF can affect the pineal gland. There's also synergistic, compounds in aluminum fluoride, aluminum glyphosate, so forth. So it gets bombarded, right? So it's a good focal point of our focus when we're trying to heal the brain and to, of course, heal insomnia. And I think that's probably why we have an epidemic of insomnia. It's like the chicken or the egg, right? But I feel like the epidemic lives from, any one of these things sounds intense, right? So it's like any one of these things, which is happening in, unfortunately, the synergistic fashion, is disrupting our production of melatonin and our potentially our ability to connect. And so melatonin actually is also the antidote. Isn't that brilliant? Melatonin helps to clear the pineal gland from these toxins. Of course, we want to educate people and try to limit exposure as much as possible, and reduce or mitigate or harmonize EMF exposure as much as possible. And so yes, I feel that the pineal gland needs very much a lot of attention these days. And I think, of course, your summit's going to be, I'm sure many people are going to be talking about it and educating us, but it's kind of like the new frontier, right, of how to address brain health. We need to really look at the pineal gland as the source of healing for the diseases that plague the brain.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. It really is. Let's move attention to GABA. Neurotransmitter has a huge amount of roles to play in the body, from sort of learning, long-term memory, but it has a really important role to play in sleep regulation. I wonder if you could explain a little about what it is for those who maybe don't know, and the role that it has in sleep.
Absolutely. So GABA is pretty well known in, our world, right? And GABA is known as an inhibitory neurotransmitter to help with anxiety and stress. And it's really impactful for sleep. And it also, the pineal gland actually plays a role in GABA production. I didn't realize that until I studied this. But by inhibiting different parts of different activities in the brain, kind of, that's why people in, who have low GABA enjoy alcohol, because GABA, just think of, if you have a drink, like everything's slowed down, right? Your inhibitory pathways are sometimes, for some people, are compromised, right? And so it just helps with slowing things down, inhibiting those stressful parts of the brain. It also helps with the breakdown of serotonin to increase melatonin. That's something I learned. So that really helps with sleep. It also shows that, just another connection that I learned, a statistic that GABA levels are reduced by 30% in adults with the people with chronic insomnia. And then again, the low GABA is going to be associated with insomnia, anxiety, chronic stress, depression, difficulty concentrating, even headaches. And it's just a really important inhibitory stress and reduction neurotransmitter, and is really important for sleep because of its interaction with serotonin, which helps to create melatonin. And then I mentioned already before that it helps to enter, like a GABA, when it's regulated by the pineal gland and the pineal sites in the pineal gland, it helps to modulate that entry from deep sleep into REM sleep, is my understanding.
And are you able to explain some of the transportation issues, particularly for GABA, across the blood-brain barrier? Because it's not just a simple sort of point of delivery, is it?
There's, many people are like, oh, we need GABA, but how do we get, it's like medicine, always like we can have all the right ideas, but it's getting to the right areas of the body to have an effect. And so we know that if we just take straight GABA, that it's very hard to absorb and to deliver, from the, GABA that's ingested to get it into, the brain, right? It's just, poorly bioavailable. There's been some biohacks like liposomal GABA is definitely a biohack. Pharma GABA is, definitely a biohack to make a more absorbable, GABA in order to have its chance to get delivered, into the brain, but also working with the enteric nervous system and the gut microbiome and, all the, effects that it has, like indirect effects as well. The drug gabapentin, why it's worked so well, is they have a patent on how to cleave GABA and get it into the, how to get it absorbed, in the gut. Of course, there's side effects to it, but that's, why that works. And then there's a transdermal approach that Dr. Ruggiero, he created a product that we collaborate on and that he educated me that when we think about how the body is connected. So I love talking about the fascia and the living matrix and this kind of idea that we are connected from our skin to our nucleus through this fascial network of interconnection. And there's many different layers to this, but just for a moment, think about the fascia. It has other names, connective tissue, interstitial tissue, so forth. It is full of collagen, but also these proteoglycans. And proteoglycans are proteins with these glycosaminoglycans. And one glycosaminoglycan is called chondroitin sulfate. And chondroitin sulfate is part of the feathery-like projections on the protein cores. And it helps to move and transport throughout the fascial network. And so we use chondroitin sulfate with a form of GABA to basically absorb along the skin. And then that is delivered kind of like a liposomal technology. It's delivered through the fascial system because of its application near the brain across the blood-brain barrier, and it has an effect more very rapidly to improve all phases of sleep. We found not just that deep to REM, but also sleep latency. So that's what we have learned. And again, it's Dr. Marco Ruggiero's brilliance to figure this out. And then he showed me a lot of research around, the interstitium and chondroitin sulfate and how this is, I believe, a whole untapped tool for our time using the skin to affect the brain.
Fascinating. And what are some of the other nutrient deficiencies that you might expect to see with people with sleep disturbance or insomnia?
Mm-hmm. So we talked about melatonin, right? We talked about GABA. I touched on B6. There's a lot of different, every neurotransmitter, when we just have our lens on biochemistry, right? Every neurotransmitter has its ability to be produced, has a stream of what we call cofactors, and cofactors help turn on enzymes to produce different neurotransmitters. So that's going to be the world of B vitamins, the world of biotin, the world of NAD, the world of looking at methylation blocks, so that's, one whole rabbit hole that I hope you cover, on the summit, or I'm sure you'll give resources on. And then, when we think about other nutritional deficiencies and ways to support the body, serotonin, of course, is important because of its downstream production into melatonin. Maybe this is a good time. We were chatting right before the call about psychobiotics. So that's kind of the use of the microbiome, right, to support sleep. So the more we know about the microbiome, our, keys of our health lie in, really learning about, the microbial diversity that we are, we are humans living in a sea of microbes, right, within us. And so The psychobiotics I learned from Kiran Krishnan, who has the product Megaspore and that company in the US. And he found different strains that affect especially GABA production. So again, with the importance of GABA in, in just mental health and also sleep, he found ways to enhance the synthesis through the gut microbiome. And then it, you know, the body knows best on how to transport, you know, what it synthesizes and to help, balance the brain. So there's, I'm sure, many more things. I look a lot of about how to reduce stressors and interference fields and environmental stress. And, you know, also there's a whole conversation about how different, you know, toxicants affect, you know, sleep, and pathogens can affect sleep and all sorts of things. But again, all roads lead to melatonin. Melatonin is a way to address a lot of those things as well.
Yeah, that's the overall message of our discussion today.
That could be my clip, right?
That's it. And so lifestyle tools, you know, there are many lifestyle tools that we've already spoken about here in terms of EMF exposure and light exposure. What about body temperature regulation? How does that interplay?
Yeah, you know, I met the wonderful people at Chili Pad, which is just an American company, and I'm sure there's going to be many more, but it has technology that basically has this mattress that's very thin on the bed that pumps water, and you can regulate the temperature. And that alone, having a cooler core body temperature at night impacts getting into deep and REM sleep for many people, especially, you know, women who are going through transitional phases with their hormones and they struggle with hot flashes. That keeps them up at night, right? Of course, not only the disturbance of a hot flash, but that heat in the body, that excessive heat, is very disruptive to our sleep. Many patients with persistent Lyme and chronic Lyme have a co-infection called babesia, and that often manifests as night sweats. So that can also disrupt sleep. So this, I feel like if we get our core body temperature down, I think it's about 1 to 2 degrees in our core body temperature, it really enhances our sleep quality.
Yeah. Obviously, we've spoken a lot about detoxification and supporting detoxification. So are you a fan of taking a binder at night to kind of aid and support that process?
Yeah, there's a great, ritual that we can do at night to enhance, sleep and support detoxification. So I mentioned the transdermal GABA, I mentioned melatonin. We also open, the lymphatic chain at night in the neck, so the brain has somewhere to go, and then a binder. So we often use different binders. There's different zeolites and chlorellas and fulvic acids. I love BioPure ZeoBind. I love all the cell core binders, especially HMET. Those are great strategies, for people to use at night to capture what's being mobilized. For some patients, when we're going through a pretty intense detoxification protocol, we will use chelation like DMSA. So they might be mobilizing metal from their brain. When we're using the higher doses of melatonin, we'll use DMSA, and that can help with the grogginess that happens in the morning. It's not always melatonin, and the effects of the melatonin hangover, it can sometimes be that mobilization of toxicity that's not addressed enough, that people are feeling groggy from in the morning.
Dr. Shevna, thank you for sharing your expertise with us. It has been truly fascinating. If people would like to find out more about your work specifically, where can we direct them to?
Well, thank you so much. I have a website. It's drchristineschaffner.com. I have a podcast. Alex has been on that podcast, and I have a number of guests who just inspire me and I learn from. And then I have a website also for my clinic. I have a clinic in Seattle. We do a lot of telemedicine all over as well. And that's eminencehealth.com.
Fantastic. Wonderful. And I hope everyone has enjoyed listening today, and I am sure we will meet again soon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.